Well, Chris, thanks very much for taking the time.
Yeah, man.
We really appreciate it. It was a great opportunity to connect with a company that's doing a lot about time as well. And we said from the very beginning, our company's main core competency and vision is to be a company about time and convenience. The product we want to do is to save time for people so they can focus on what's important. And Kane Watches, in particular, for me, has been a really nice brand. I've been following you guys for the past 6 months, I think.
Oh, cool.
When you first appeared in front of my horizon, and I really enjoyed the things you were doing online. And I do like the watches as well.
That's important.
I really like the designs.
Yeah.
But, and I want to start with one question. Is why watches?
Oh yeah, I've heard that question before. Watches, yeah. It's something like when I was during my student days, I was doing all these different jobs in fashion, and one of the jobs was to work in the Bagincourt, which is the department store. On the main floor, they have all these watches, and I was working for this distribution company, selling Guess. And I didn't like those watches, but I had to wear them all the time. And then there were a lot of people coming to me, like asking me, oh, should I get this watch? Or what about the Dolce & Gabbana and then the Armani, whatever. And I was always like, well, you know, I know it's complicated. You have so much choice.
Right.
So that always stuck with me in my mind. Then after I did my master's, I did international management. I said, I don't want to become a consultant. I just want to do something completely different. And I'm going to figure it out when I'm in Asia. So I went to Asia and I stayed there for about 1.5 years. Did everything that's different from school, but I got into fashion more. By chance, doing a lot of modeling there, then working on productions. And I met a few guys that were doing this company in wooden sunglasses. They were from Spain. And after 1.5 years, I said, well, fun time's over. Let's get back to work. Came back to the Netherlands, tried to find a few jobs. Then I realized, like, yeah, I really want to do this entrepreneurship thing. And sunglasses, yeah, it doesn't really matter. I thought it was pretty cool. It was a trend. Maybe it can help them. So I started putting that in the market for them, going to all these trade shows in Paris and in Milan and in Berlin, and just trying to get this product on the market through the retail channels. It was a hard, hard sell, and we were very premium. So through that business, after 2.5 years, I met a guy that Christian Becker is a good friend of mine now. He was also in sunglasses, and he also had wooden sunglasses before. And I was like, dude, that's so interesting. So a meeting that was supposed to be like, hi, just meet and greet, you guys seem to fit each other through a mutual connection, turned out into an 8-hour, like, hanging out, like, looking at websites and new designs and everything. And he said, yeah, I'm really thinking about stopping with the sunglasses. I'm like, why? He said, well, for many reasons. First one, in the Netherlands, there's no sun. So, and I'm like, okay, what other product would you do then? I'm like, well, my brother is into watches. He sells a lot of watches. I'm like, oh, watches, yeah. I always wanted to have a product that I could show people, because I'd go out to a club or something, they'd be, oh, you're in sunglasses. Do you have one? I'm like, no, it's weird to wear sunglasses at night, unless you're a vampire. So I said, well, a watch is something I could always show, and it has a certain value, and I like watches. My dad collects watches, whose dad doesn't, almost, right? And so I started really thinking about that. Okay, watch brand. And he started a female watch brand, and I said, well, if you're gonna go a female route, why don't I start going the male route? And I came to my parents and said, like, I know what I'm gonna do. I said, oh, you're gonna work at Google? Are you gonna work at Unilever? Like, no, I'm gonna start my own watch brand. I said, watch brand? A lot of watches out there, aren't there, Chris? You know that. You've sold watches at the Bagincourt. How are you gonna, you know? I said, no, it's a different world out there. Like, you should see all these big companies that sell through Instagram, and they grow like mushrooms, and they're super fast, and they make more money than all these other brands. And so they're like, yeah, but still watches. Like, you've got all the smart watches coming, and like, you know, I'm just still gonna do what I wanna do, because I have this idea of creating a watch that I could show to my friends and be really proud of, that I custom design, that has this look and feel that it looks expensive, but then it's not. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't say anything about the quality. Quality is still up there, but it's really like that, oh, a really nice watch, I think it's 300 euros. And then I said, no, it's just 99. And like, oh, really? That's very accessible, that price. It's like, okay, if I have that, I really wanted to work on this concept. But then, okay, watch is still a generic product.
Yeah.
price, well, at some point somebody will figure out how to get the price down and do something very similar. You're going to target men. That has something going for you, but at the same time, you know, they're not that active on social media. And so what else can you add? You need a brand story, you need something. So I was like, well, if I'm going to make a brand, then better be a brand that relates to me, who I am. So I must say I had a lot of help with my ex-girlfriend. She was a fashion designer and also helped me with branding, knew me very well. So we sat down, drew a mind map. What does Chris like? And how can we build that into something that is masculine, looks good, has a great story, and is unique? Because you need to have a good story in order to defend your market space, right? Go for that niche. So I was really happy with the choice of going for watches. And then if you have any more questions, and I can go into like the brand itself and how I came up with the current branding that we have.
What's really interesting is because we're at this stage right now, our idea was born 1 year ago, about 1st of September last year, actually.
Okay.
And we had absolutely no touch to the fashion industry, to the textiles. Our background is programmers.
Oh, really?
And before that, marketer and event person. So actually, what was your very first step after you had this idea? What did you do and go to start making this happen?
Well, after talking with my parents, they always advise. So I said, you know, what's the next step? I'd go to a watch fair. Actually, maybe even before the watch fair, I just went back to the bank or had a look.
Mm-hmm.
What's out there? What can I find? Like the easiest access. But at some point, I was like, okay, I need to find suppliers.
Right.
How am I going to find suppliers? Well, you go to trade fairs. But then you come into a whole different type of world where how do you know what a good supplier is? You got to visit factories. It's usually abroad, it's far away. So how do you manage that? So I got, my first step was figure out what does the watch market look like where I am right now. Then what is the next step? It's kind of like from the Canvas business model generation kind of book where you look for what are the key puzzle pieces that it will need then. So first one was supplier. Then you can start thinking about design. And I really mapped it out like in a roadmap. Okay, these months are going to be production, then this is going to be design, or this is going to be marketing. And they had a lot of overlap too, of course.
How long was your initial roadmap?
I started in 2015, September. That was the first fair I went to when I had the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was still trying to get rid of my sunglasses and finish that business to start with a clean slate, like full focus. So I didn't have like a proper office and there was nothing there.
Yeah.
But in December, then I started emailing the factories that I had visited and starting to gather information, a lot of research. At some point, a factory asked me, like, Chris, when is your design coming? Because we've counted the emails. You've sent over 300 to us with questions. And my strategy was, and that's maybe a cool tip for the listeners, is I found 5 different factories and I asked them all the same questions and I made a huge, like huge spreadsheet of all the questions with all the factories like this and I asked them the same one because I would always get a different answer.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'd have like my control factory that I know that were better than the rest and then have all the other ones giving me information and then cross-check them. So it's not just 300 emails to one factory, it's to everyone. So I was pretty busy with my research and development phase, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I knew what the boundaries were of what I could design and I had a certain idea, I just took a pen and paper and started drawing. Like what would it be? And then just whole stack of sheets, just kept drawing, looking at all the watch brands. I've like watch books, like stacks of them, and just looking through it. What elements do I like?
Right.
And then really getting into like, okay, but there's so many like elements. How can I simplify this? Because that kind of ties in back to being at the bank or the department serving. People cannot choose. Why? What is their problem? Why does a mom not know what to buy for her son? Or why does a girlfriend not know what to buy for her boyfriend? Why does the guy not know what to buy for himself or for his friend's birthday? It's because every watch has a very specific characteristic. It's either a dress one, or this pilot one, or a diver watch, or a sports watch. but it's so complicated that you don't know if it's going to match the person. So I was thinking, okay, well, if I make a watch that, how can I make a watch that matches everybody? Mm-hmm. Then I thought about the idea of modularity. It was a little bit of a trend, but I was like, yeah, but then you have all these, nobody's going to like twist off things and put things together. And I already saw that as a logistical nightmare in production as well. And there's a lot of customer questions that I can already come up like. So then I was like, okay, how about simplification, going essential, like following maybe like Japanese kind of minimalism, because I didn't really like Scandinavian minimalism. I like Dutch minimalism, but I wanted to have something different than Dutch and Scandinavian. So I looked more towards the East, and because I'm Dutch and I'm Cantonese, and that mix of the two, I always wanted to build that bridge between Europe and Asia somehow. And I figured, well, let's do that in the brand then, because a lot of production is done over there anyway. But what if I do the branding there as well? So Hong Kong didn't sound very exciting to all my friends. They had no idea what goes on there. I knew a financial hub and I like going there, but I thought, well, Bangkok, I lived there for a while. Is that interesting? No. Jakarta? No, it's not worth. Not Singapore, no. Then I came up with Tokyo, and I was like, yeah, I like that. I was there once when I was 18 for 3 days, and that was a cool vibe to it. Started reading a little bit more about Japanese minimalism and things like that. And then I realized, yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's going back to the essentials. Rather than having a wall full of pictures, having a clean wall with one picture brings that one picture to life. I like that. So I took that philosophy and used that in the design, just thinking, okay, what is really essential in the watch? What's not? Initially, I actually wanted to make two watches, one casual, one dress, for the simple reason that I did not know how I was going to finance both productions. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, simplify. How about blend them together? On the one end, you have dress watches, and I always felt dress watches are more of a heritage. You need heritage for that. Like, I'm not a dress watch brand. By the way, I don't dress like I'm going to work at a consultancy all the time. So that's one thing. Then I like casual watches, but I think they're too big and bulky. I like Nixon, I like all these American styles, and I like Diesel, for instance, but that was cool when I was 18. Now I'm a little bit older, so I want something a bit more sophisticated that I could wear when I'm on a date or other people could wear at a job interview. Or when you go out for dinner with your parents or something. So I'm trying to find this way, this balance, like, okay, why don't we just put them together? So I took a dress watch that I had in my mind, something very simple and clean. Then I started making it more masculine and cool by taking different angles in the watch. So if you take the watch and you look at the watch that I created, here, everything has angles in it. The only round part is actually the crown and the case itself. Even the, here you see the hands, the minute markers, the hour markers, the logo, everything has a little bit of a blocky, angular design approach in it. And that's how I thought, well, that's how I'm gonna make it like look a bit more cool. And then by using different type of materials, you can also make it a little bit less dressy or more dressy. You use leather or you use stainless steel. And As we made prototypes, we got the first ones in, was like, it's terrible. I was like, I'm never going to be able to sell this. I thought, you know, you just send some design files and you get it back. And at first that was more my own design. Mm-hmm. That was not so good. Then I really told her, like, I think you need to help me a little bit more on the design part. Like, really, like, tell me yes or no when I say this element and this width. And so we formed a really good team where I'd have an idea in my mind and she would just double check with her if it would look good. And she helped me a lot with, like, the drawing parts because I was not so good in Photoshop. I could do a little bit of Illustrator. But I was very good at managing production and making Excel files and doing that. So it was a really good collaboration. And then I think maybe within a week, by just going to all these shops, looking at all these watches again that are out there, we're like, no, this is the right element. That's the wrong element. This is the size. And then we just tested it out, printed things, And then we sent off the files, and about 2 months later, a box arrived with a watch in it. And when I opened the box, it was a really exciting moment. The watch was exactly how we envisioned it. It was perfect. It was really, I was like, okay, I think with this, we can go into full production. And in a way, it was very rare. What happened was, because I switched all the factories I talked with before, they're all gone. It's a bit sad because I put a lot of time, but I also paid a lot of money for molds and all these things. But it's like, something is wrong in this whole process of creativity and then production. That's why I got a watch that just doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. And we also shaved off all the, like, to the tenth of a millimeter or less. We went into making sure that there's a balance. It just has to feel right. The consumer might not see the difference, but you subconsciously notice, like, mm-hmm. wait, something, this is right. So, yeah, we went into full production. It took about 2 months. Then we had all the watches, but packaging was still slow because I was meticulous about packaging. I really wanted to create a box that people would be like, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like the watch. You can't have like a sloppy box and then watch that's in there. And the box was really my own little project. I got help, but I really focused on making it myself, an illustrator, and bringing elements back, like the hands that you see, they're all angular. So in the box, we also made that angular. It's a clamshell box that opens. I could grab you one in a second. And looking at material and the size and just the overall feel and look, like the paper that we use is a special type of paper, like matte oil finishing that mm-hmm. if you scratch it, it actually looks better. So like, hey, that's gonna be great if people knock it around in right. in a store or something like that. So the version that we have now today is version 33. Yeah. Just to give you an idea, it took over a year to just produce that box. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with so many shipments going back and forth, testing, and I've been abroad so many times to visit the factories too, just to double check, go over a few things, ask all my friends, which one do you like? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now, I mean, yeah, that's the biggest compliment I can get, is that when people actually buy the watch, and then they get the box, so I get emails of people asking me, where did you produce that box? Yeah.
Just touching on production again, where do you manufacture the watch and the box, and how are you managing that remote manufacturing process?
Yeah, okay, very good question. So the factories are across the border from Hong Kong, so Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Dongguan. Yeah, that's where all the watches are being made these days in that type of price category. But the timepiece itself, like the inside, that comes from Japan, which was for me really a great coincidence, and I really wanted that because I had Citizen Psycho sit actually at this table here, and that was only a few months ago, but before that I'd been emailing them like, hey, who's better, Psycho or Citizen? And they were both like battling it out. Then I asked in those emails that I sent like, who's better? And I figured out that I want to work with Citizen. Yeah, so that's what we have. So we get the timepiece itself, we mm-hmm. get that, and then we have everything assembled across the border from Hong Kong. Yeah. So how would you manage that remotely? That is,
Do you go there often, or is there a lot of packaging sent back and forth?
Yeah, I talk to them almost every day. My team doesn't realize that, but I'm always behind the scenes on my phone on WeChat talking with upgrades, new productions, updates, feedback, quality control, that kind of stuff. And it's a continuous process. But you really got to find, and I wrote this in the blog because I had this question before, you really got to find the partner that's willing to invest in you, but that you can also trust and has the time to work with you. And that's the hardest part, because the suppliers that we have now they have the capacity for growth, but they also need to make money. Mm-hmm. So they have a lot of other brands too, which you want, but at the same time, if they have very big brands to work with, they're gonna not do a production run with you for a few thousand watches. It's not interesting for them. Why would they do that? So through connections and like, I brought my mom, she spoke with them too. we found the partners that I felt comfortable with, that didn't have too many brands, mm-hmm. But that they were also in the growth phase, but we're meticulous about quality. Absolutely meticulous. No, I would send a lot of prototypes from back and forth, a lot of tests. We send watch to lab for testing the coding to see if they were really doing what they were saying. I went to all the coding factories, also spoke with the people that are there and really got all the information. Like, one of the things I learned is like, you got to be super curious and you really want to become an expert. From someone who just sold watches at the bank or not really knowing much about guests and plating and stuff, it just people would buy it anyway, to where I am now, where I might not know everything about watches, but I do know my own product a lot better than when I started. Yeah, so any customer questions, I usually have the answer for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when you started, did you start immediately full-time on Kane watches, or were you balancing that with the day job?
No, full-time. Yeah, so I made some money with the sunglasses, then I had business partners, so I shared some of the profits from that, and I was able to get a few of the sunglasses that I still had in stock here. So during the whole summer, I was selling them on the market, just making money to survive and pay the rent here. Then I shared this rental space with a good friend of mine who is also a graphic designer, so he could always give me a little bit of help on the fonts and things like that, and good eye. So yeah, that's how I did it. Yeah. Yeah. So you don't need much if you bootstrap. Like,
yeah.
If you can pay your rent and you have 300 euros to spare for food, you can do it.
Pretty much, exactly.
Yeah.
And then you have this whole control of the whole process yourself.
Yeah.
Without relying on investors or...
Without asking people.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is that something that you also...
Yeah. We're bootstrapping as well. Self-funding the whole operation. And
cool.
It has some limitations for sure in terms of how much you can afford to spend on product development or in production
and speed to market.
Exactly.
But
we are, it's the two of us, and we have a very good supplier. We have a very good relationship with him, and we were very lucky also to find him because we did an extensive research process of finding
Excel sheets as well.
So your story actually
sounds very familiar.
And actually, we're currently making the box we chose has a black matte finish.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go.
We relied on that one for
that's interesting.
Super important.
Yeah.
The whole experience. And actually, maybe you can talk about that. How do you think about crafting the user experience from the first touch point that the customer has with the brand to receiving the product and wearing it?
Yeah, so because a lot of people find us through the internet, from Instagram or Facebook advertisement, when I initially started, I said, well, if I'm gonna have a generic product that anybody can copy it, how am I going to defend myself? How do you make your brand defensible?
Mm-hmm.
I knew what I was good at. I've been on so many photo shoots, been working with all these magazines. I knew my eyes now was trained to see what I like and what I don't. And I really believe that what I like is something that other people could also like. So initially I used the camera myself to take pictures and things. And then I realized quickly, like, yeah, I think I can make better content than anybody else out there.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one strength, and I'm always looking back at what am I good at and what am I naturally good at, which comes easy to me, but it's difficult for others. And I think it's content creation. And that's the way also you entice people and build a brand and send out a message. And I think that our message has been developing over time a lot better. We're still not there. I'm still not happy where we are. We can go next level. I think we're now on par with a lot of other brands out there, or maybe a little bit above that, but I think we can really like shoot through the roof where other people cannot catch up anymore. And there's a project that we're working on that's going to help, and I can tell you about that. But
please do.
You want to talk?
It's not a secret.
No, it's not a secret. No, it's not a secret. How do I start? So one of my goals with Kane was to build this company as more of like a platform for other people to use and to get where they want to go. So for me, it was in order to start teaching other people how to do business. I said, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur, but I also want to teach in university in places, but then I need a good story. So let me first build that story and then start teaching. Yeah, actually tomorrow is my first group of students that are coming by that I'm going to help built their business model for their Master Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the UFA.
Okay,
yeah.
Nice.
And this summer I did a seminar, and last year did a seminar as well about entrepreneurship. But so if Kane is that platform, because I want to answer your question, if Kane is that platform to bring out my vision, how can I get other people on board of my vision where they also sort of get where they want to go? So if both visions cross, then we can both work towards the same goal. So that's always been my goal. Last year, and now I'm going to get to the story. So that's the backdrop. Last year, through a friend, I met Brendan. Brendan Murphy is a Hollywood movie director from LA. And I didn't really know much about him. But when he came here, he was alone. And his friend, which is my friend as well, so a mutual friend, he said, just take him out, just have some fun. And we had a really great time. It was super fun. So 3 days here in Amsterdam. And I told him about this. He asked me, what are you doing, Chris? I'm like, well, working on this watch that I'm designing. And he's like,
how far back was that?
This was last year summer. Yeah. So I said, well, I only have prototype. And he's like, oh, okay, cool, man. But I like that you're doing what you love. Like, same for me. I'm working on becoming like a bigger movie director and editor and producer of film. So I said, well, let's keep in touch. So he said, hey, Chris, I'm coming back. And that was this summer. So this summer, just 2 months ago. And he said, but my brother's also coming like 2 weeks after me. So let's have some fun. And then after that, you have some fun with my brother. And I didn't know what his brother did. And he said, well, my brother's a cinematographer, also from Hollywood. Or that's at least where they already live for over a decade. And I said, what does that mean? And like, oh yeah, it means that he handles the camera. I'm like, oh, okay. So I went on a Tuesday night, I went out with Kieran, his brother. It's 5 a.m. in the morning, and we walked down Varmostrat. And he's like, hey, Chris, why don't you stand over there? You used the model, why don't you stand against the wall? I'm like, okay, I'll look cool and stuff. And there was a taxi parked there, and he was having his foot on the brake lights. So there was this red light coming through the street. And he caught that so nicely with his camera phone. I was like, this is amazing. And he's like going low and making angles. So I got a few of these pictures and went to a club as well. And also had this red light in the club. So he really liked shooting with me. And I really enjoyed it so much to work with such a creative person, because I saw the end result. And then he just hold his phone and make some adjustments to color. And like, boom, here, I sent it to you. Got it. Wow. It's going to be cool on Facebook. So I really liked working with Kieran, and Kieran also said, yeah, I know, Brendan also talked a little bit about your brand and stuff, and I really think you're onto something here. And well, we kind of want to do something in Europe, because we're Irish and we have Irish passports, but we've never really done any work here, but we need to build a portfolio or get crew and connection network. Maybe we can help each other. I was like, okay. So they went back to LA, and I said, well, I might go to the States this year. Oh, if you come to LA, then we'll definitely shoot something for Kane. And on Messenger, I wrote them a message like, didn't you have this video reel? I kept missing, I didn't see that yet. And I said, yeah, have a look. And I looked at the reel and I was like, holy shit, these guys are really good. Yeah, I should have done my due diligence, you know, before. But and so I told him, like, oh, I really like this, and I like the light, and it reminds me of Enter the Void, and it reminds me of Neon Demons. And then he said, dude, you exactly get where we get our inspiration from. Like, you're familiar with all these movies and the cinematography that's part of it. And then they brought out a short film, and they used, it looked similar to like what Ghost in the Shell would look like in a short film, but a completely different concept and story behind it, of course. But I liked it so much. It's like, wow. That really fits into like Tokyo and the neon and the parties I used to go to with like a lot of TL, like neon colors, from green, blue, red, purple. And so I got really a bit excited, and I told Brendan, like, hey, how about, do you still want to do that movie? And he said, yeah, man, I still want to do it. I said, well, if we're going to do it, and I said to him, we got to do it fast, because I can't wait another half year or something. I said, yeah, okay, let me check my schedule. And he said, well, I got 1 week in October for you. And I said, October, that's like in less than 2 months. He said, yeah, I've seen movie production happen faster than that. And like, are you sure? I don't know. Yeah, Chris, you're going to be a producer. Like, I don't even know what that means. That means, no, you got to get everybody together on the ground there, because we can only do so much from LA. And he said to me, like, Chris, from this day forward, if we're really gonna do this, you have to talk with me every day, at least 1 hour. Like, well, I'm pretty busy, but yeah, but we're gonna do something really big together. I don't know what that means, big together. Like, yeah, I'm gonna kill it for you. Like, if my brother's on it, like, we're definitely gonna go crazy. And so it comes down to this. On the 7th of October, there are four people, Brendan and Kieran. So we got a director, producer, editor, and Kieran, cinematographer, his first assistant camera guy, because he wanted to have his own camera guy on set. And Brendan's girlfriend, who is a fantastic makeup and FX artist. So for crew, he said, we'll do it for free. Everybody's gonna do it for free. Just fly us over there, put us in a place where we feel comfortable, and then we'll have 1 week to work on this project. We'll do location scouting and everything. So, okay, I guess I could pay for the tickets. Yeah, I could get that out of my budget. I think this is too big of a cool thing to do to not take that money and invest. And as we started talking about 2-3 weeks ago, every day, and as things are coming together, I start to realize, like, Brendan, you're really serious about this. He said, yeah, Chris, we need a truck. We need two trucks, because one for prop items, one's for lighting. We need these and these people. I said, but where and how am I going to pay for that? And like, we need a gaffer. We need two people that are grips. We need a DIT. We need a stylist. We need your whole team on board as well to help with whatever. We need catering. We need, like, I know, but what's the budget like? And so we figured out a budget that would cover the cost. And so most of the money would actually go to the camera, because Kieran does not shoot with a simple camera. Mm-hmm. He shoots with the best and only the best. And he wants also all the lenses too, because he needs to have all that. And then he said, I need an assistant director, and I need a UPM, a unit production manager, that's gonna do everything. Like, this list is just endless. But the good thing is that I just looked, who do I know and who can I get on board of the vision? So that's why I wanted to talk about Kane and the vision being like a platform for other people. Mm-hmm. So talk to everybody that I know. And actually I found one of my first customers, Nikki, his name is. And Nikki came in Christmas last year. That's when we launched our website and thing. And he came to the office and he bought 3 watches. And I said, how'd you find us? He said, oh, I saw you on Instagram. I just thought it was a really cool watch. I said, but we hardly have anything on Instagram, like maybe 20 posts. I said, oh, it looked cool. And so Nikki and I always had stayed in touch. And Nikki was not in film, but he's in, he produces, he helps on huge productions of festivals, major artists that come to the Netherlands. He is there with his team. And it's a young guy of 23 years old, and he's done close to 500 productions already. And I sat down with him and I said, you know who's coming to the Netherlands? He said, no. These two people that I know from LA were gonna do a Hollywood production, but they need help from me, but I need help more than they need help. Do you think that would be something that, do you know anybody? Because I need somebody that organizes everything. And he said, I will do it, I'll do it all. And we'll do it. He was really on board last week, and he said by Friday, this Friday, we'll have everything ready. That's very ambitious.
That's incredible.
But he is that type of guy. So we had a meeting on Sunday, and he also has like people that he knows in film, so they're also on board. And I just need to now make sure that there's enough money, that we get the locations, because that's what I'm good at, using my network there. Finding the girl that's going to play, and then making sure that my team is ready to do the marketing launch of this whole mm-hmm. campaign. So that's actually after we shoot, the second phase will be, they're going to be editing everything, and then we will be using our influencer network. We've worked with over 300 now, and probably we'll have like up to 500 influencers that have worked with us, plus like 5,000 customers, retailers, everybody that we know is gonna be locked into a one-time like thunderclap in order to launch this online. And then we'll throw Facebook and Instagram advertising money against it as well, to make one big bang, like huge.
And so that's, who's writing the script for it? What's the story?
Yeah, Brendan is doing that. So he's also a director, so that's what he does. The story is, we want to do something that ties into the millennial scene, that crosses two genres, actually something that is very neon demons, kind of like with TL, but also film noir. This is not my idea, this was Brendan's idea. Film noir is all black and white, think Sin City, smoke, big shadows, strong lighting, 1940s clothing. And then having this more futuristic vibe, which they had shot already in their short films before. So to blend these two, which actually is kind of similar to Amsterdam and Tokyo. Neon lights, Amsterdam heritage, cobblestones, black and white, 1940s. So we're gonna do that. Mm-hmm. That is kind of like the scene, the setting, and then we had to fill it in. So I said, well, we always wanted to show the life of an inspiring person that does something that he loves and is the best at what he does, but that has built his craft over time. So it being Amsterdam dance event really soon, like the week before we shoot, a week after we have shot, I was thinking, okay, how about a DJ? And he said, yeah, that's a great idea. And how about, Brendan came up with all the ideas, by the way. And he said, well, what if you have like a little bit of this romance story, kind of like Casablanca and Third Man, where there's some kind of tension and it has to do with time, that they're like so busy with their life that they don't have time to meet up with each other. So the girl would be then the top female influencer, which makes complete sense to the millennial group. Like you're a DJ or you're an influencer and you travel the world and do cool shit. And you're like, you're playing at the top of your game, but you're not even 25 yet, you know? That's kind of the idea. So we'll have a scene where we're in the club and the guy's DJing, and then his mind goes out to that girl he once met, and he then comes into this dream world where he has this romantic scene of him being with her in the cobblestone streets of Amsterdam, maybe on a boat, and just being having this like kind of like romantic fantasy. And then as he is DJing, he has this. So at some point, he's back into his DJ set and the crowd is going wild. And he's looking in the crowd, he's like, oh, but she's not here, that girl. And at this time, you don't even know if this girl really exists. So I think I'm not gonna explain the rest of the story because otherwise...
Yeah, okay. Keep the rest for the viewers to see it.
Yeah.
When it's out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that still change. So,
of course, but that's in progress.
Yeah, so that's kind of like when we talk about content and being like content is king, and then I want to be that king that pushes out the content and be so different than any other watch brand out there. I'm not in the business of selling watches. Like, right. I really want people to get inspired to do something that they love. And one of my taglines is more that I want to say, like, let then the watch be that symbol of your commitment to your continuous improvement that you wear around your wrist every day, and you look at it every day, so it's like a stylish reminder of your move forward so that you can make your dreams your reality, something like this.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, are you, or were you at any point, especially for this project, the undertaking it's scared?
The moment I realized how many people are going to be involved in this production, super scared. But I think it was more scary in December when I realized I started doing my finances and I had a team of four people here. They're all interns, but still it's money going out every month. And we didn't have sales. We had hardly had a good website and everybody kind of didn't really know what they're doing. I didn't really know what I was doing. I knew where I wanted to go. But I saw my bank account and I was like, I don't even have money to do another month. How am I gonna do this? And I had all my money tied into production, and that was it. And I had borrowed some, not enough. And my parents really saw how stressed I was, and I really thought like I'm gonna fail before I even get started. So I was thinking about, okay, crowdfunding, but I don't know how to do that. Maybe we can get a loan, but no, banks won't do that. And my parents said, okay, how much do you need to get by another 2 months? So, well, maybe like 10,000 euros or something just to start selling some watches. Because we were selling already. I sold some watches in December. I was really scared then, but it was huge relief. And now every time I saw my bank account like go down, I noticed that my whole emotion was negative. Mm-hmm. So that's where I got my drive from. Like, okay, if I just make sure that I have enough sales, then I'll feel like get that freedom again to continuously push and build. So it's always a balance of cash flow. So I was very scared about that. But the solution was do more markets. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I'd actually stand on the market. The first markets I did on my own, sell all day. And my first market that I ever did, I sold 16 watches alone. I still had to pack them. It was really busy. It was Christmas time. I was like, okay, well, you get the money directly. That's great. You get to meet the customers, which is even better. You get to talk with them. I think I've spoken to 5,000 people easy. Like, we've done probably over 50 markets or something like that this year.
By markets, just some context, what exactly do you mean?
Local design markets, so yeah. Where other designers would come and show their products. Could be scarves, could be jewelry, could be sunglasses. Mm-hmm. And there you get the chance to do your story and test your visuals, test what people wonder about your brand, all this kind of stuff. So I think that was the best training for me. And now talking to retailers, we were at a trade show for jewelry stores, and I have now my team, and they're all like friends of mine now. We were so trained in speaking to people that nobody could walk by our stand without hearing, hello, hi, come in. Like, we would pull them in. And I think we probably, when I talked to the people at the trade show who organized it, yeah, so how did it go, Chris? I said, well, I'm pretty sure we have maybe 30 different retailers that are gonna take our product. And I said, that's insane. I said, yeah, it was a pretty good market. And I had the smallest little table. It was a square meter, it was this.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the middle of the show, and all these people with like big stands. And this was 2 weeks ago. So, and that's when Andy started. And so he's been calling everybody up to confirm the orders, and I'm managing all the production to come in at the end of the month with new visual merchandising, new packaging, everything version 34. Yeah. And then we're gonna start shipping it out. And we're talking with distributors, talking with big like online retailers. And so we're really like focusing now on sales. Because we need that money in order to build this brand up, get more exposure, do more cool stuff. Like what Sam did was go to Paris and do a little video with two influencers and things. Yeah. So this, it's all coming from here, but it's definitely like the team. Like, yeah. I can't do it alone. And everybody has such a, I told you when you guys walked in, everybody has their little area and everybody overlaps a little bit. And they all work at the markets. They all know how to pitch the brand. Everybody's trained and is loyal to the brand. And as the deal was always like, I will give you the opportunity to do what you love or want to learn, and in return for that, you show up at work.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these markets, are they in Amsterdam or do you go internationally as well?
Yeah, so right now they're in Amsterdam, and but they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. If you just look, there are hundreds.
Okay. Right. I've never heard of those actually.
No, but everything
from... sounds like an incredible opportunity to physically be there.
To test, yeah, like if you're gonna do T-shirts, like the guy next to me, he sells like 1,000 euro in T-shirts on the market, and he said, "Yeah, Chris, but this is not my business. I develop websites." And he's there with his mom, and he sells T-shirts with some Amsterdam print on it.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it makes over 1,000 in a day.
It makes a big difference, I think, when you are able to talk directly to the customer and explain. Watch your
product
and show,
yeah.
And also say why you're doing
it. And also say why, and have them try it on.
Yeah.
People always say, like, try it on, man, it's like a shoe. You never know if it fits.
Makes a big difference.
Yeah, and then, it's really important. It's one of the key books that I would recommend anybody to read is The 4 Steps to the Epiphany, by Steve Blank. He's, you could call him the godfather of the Lean Startup Movement.
Okay.
And in the first chapter, the first thing he says, get out of your office. You should not be in your office. You should be talking with your customer. Because only then do you know if your minimum viable product is really good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a good tip.
Yeah. I did take a different approach. Like, my MVP was what it is right now. But that's my style. I like to do things perfect in one time. Although I also realize you can't do everything perfect in one time because you need feedback from the market to adjust. But in the product, I really wanted to make sure that it was right from the beginning. Yeah.
So what's the, besides the big project coming up in a few weeks, what's the vision for the company and product-wise as well? Are you expanding new products?
Yeah. The vision for the company is, I always actually wanted to be international from the outset. So right now it's important to dominate your own market first, so that's Netherlands, but we'll expand next year very quickly to Germany, France, Belgium, UK, also Spain, we already have contacts there. And then beyond that, I want to go to Asia as soon as possible. That's for me, feels like playing at home. Like when you play a match, that's like playing at home for me. And I think that's also one of the, yeah, it comes easy for me to be around those people there and some matching culture. So build a brand here in Europe, get a name, then take your Western product to Asia and have them all rave about it and then buy it. And then there you have a bigger, even bigger market. Mm-hmm. So in to explain why, or to basically show that I already was thinking internationally, was the booklet that I created for with the manual and how you change your watch and your warranty. It's already translated in 7 languages. I didn't have any customers yet, but I knew that I'd have German customers at some point because Instagram reaches so far. So I have German, French, Italian, Spanish, Polish, even English and Dutch as the main languages in the booklet. And that's the strategy, to clone our stores into all these different languages, German, yeah, well, all the ones I just mentioned. And then from there on out, like really hit that market very specifically. But you need a big team and you need a careful strategy. And that's where I lean a lot on my friend Christian that I met through the sunglasses because he's right downstairs. He's done this already. He's in thousands of stores worldwide. So he has like a blueprint in a way. Like I see the steps ahead of me. And then with our like Kaizen kind of way, I look at that. And then I try to improve that before I even do it. Yeah. So.
And is the strategy being more of an online, like translating the shop, or is it going into more doors?
Yeah, we're going to do a hybrid strategy. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, always wanted to do that. My background with the sunglasses was more optician, so that was very business to business. And I like that. Mm-hmm. And I know that consumers love, everybody loves going into a shop and just feeling a product. But then I want to be a master in online as well. Really giving that shop experience that you usually would have, making that very exciting to be online. So this week we're redesigning our website completely. Mm-hmm. And then next week we're having a new development team help us build this. Yeah, we always want to have like a gamified website, which drives conversion, but is going to be different than what other people would expect from a watch brand. Yeah.
Yeah, we want to be respectful of your time, by the way, and I think we kind of almost exceeded our limit.
No idea how much time has passed.
But it's so nice talking to you.
That's cool.
We have a lot of also people who are listening. We're going to link out to Kane and to all the accounts that you have, but can you mention also where can people find out more about the brand, maybe about yourself or any other things that you want just people to check out?
Yeah, well, definitely check out our Instagram. We do a lot of stories now, so... Mm-hmm. Every time we go do a shoot, we have a behind the scenes. So if you go to our stories, you'll see that. We're bringing out a lot of more video content. This is our first month that we really focus on video versus pictures. And we're going to do 5 videos in production. And that in order to test for the Hollywood production that's coming out. So definitely check that out. Check out our website. Now you'll see a very minimalistic, simple, clean design, kind of fits the watch. But what we're missing is that really like that branded feel. But we'll get there. So by mid-October, I think we'll have our first phase of that rebranding, so that by time November and December hits, we're going to be ready.
And the website is canewatches.com?
Yeah, canewatches.com. Very simple.
Expect the new website.
Yeah.
Very brown.
Yeah. And we also do a lot of different product launches. So we just launched the gold watch. Mm-hmm. We're also going to do something special towards the end of the year for Christmas, and definitely something for the new year as well. Yeah.
Fantastic.
We'll be following.
Yeah.
Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks
welcome.
A lot.
Thank you too. Yeah, enjoyed that.